You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the extended podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this week's show, in an interview recorded live at Sci-Fi London, the twice-yearly London Science Fiction and Fantasy Film Festival, I'm talking to artist Kevin O'Neill about his work, from the adaptations of his comics Shock, as the film Hardware, and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen on the big screen, to his early days in comics, working on left-field strips in 2000 AD, and getting initially banned in America for his work on Green Lantern. First, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of checks, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
The film that we're going to show tonight...
What were you starting to show?
Hardware.
Oh, Hardware.
Which
okay,
is based
right.
on your short story, Shock.
Yes.
Which was one of Rojor's terror tales in 2000 AD.
Okay.
Rojor's had started off as a character in Robusters,
uh-huh.
which had started off in Star-Lords. It was, took a long journey for that character to end up introducing a Judge Dredd story. I mean...
what happened? I mean, the annual stories that we did for the 2000 AD annuals were back in those days, I was... I think I might still be on staff. So they were the kind of training ground. That's where we all started. We could kind of do what we wanted. They had no budget to pay us very much money. And they were kind of grateful for filling up pages with origination that wasn't reprint, anything that looked good. And I had this idea for, a story where this robot is cannibalised by a sculptor and comes back to life. It's kind of very, it's very much like a Richard Matheson type thing, actually. But the curious thing about Hardware was I'd heard from someone on Time Out that they'd seen Hardware on advanced screening, and it reminded them of this 2000 AD story that we'd done. And then IPC became interested and had their lawyers look at it. And then there was a huge jump from that to Robert Maxwell's lawyers, who'd just taken over 2000 AD, ringing me and saying, if I didn't sign a bit of paper, I'd be sued. Which is quite a jump, really, frankly, as I was absolutely I had no connection to the movie. I was shown the movie at a screening that they gave to us, and I could see it had similarities, shall we say, to what we'd done. And I signed off on it, and I've never seen it since, actually. I've no idea if we get any credit on a movie. I suspect...
You were meant to. I think that was part of the legal case, you know?
I suspect we haven't, though. Did you see it? Or was it up there?
I think it's in the end credits, hopefully.
And the end credits, well, I mean, basically what happened in those days, we were so grateful for the work that being ripped off by movies didn't seem like such a big deal, frankly. And I got paid some pitiful amount of money and this threat of a lawsuit. I thought the film was actually very good. I actually liked it. I thought it was very... it's kind of guerrilla filmmaking. It was kind of cheap, but a lot of energy behind it. And I enjoyed it more than a lot of the kind of high-end Hollywood crap that was coming out at the same time. But we were aware on 2000 AD that our work was being constantly cannibalised. By Hollywood. In fact, I know that the makers of RoboCop, who pretty much stole Judge Dredd wholesale, had huge piles of 2000 ADs in the office, which they were going through,
nice.
culling stuff from. And we all recognised it. And of course, the effect that had was when they made the Judge Dredd movie a few years later, they didn't want to be compared with RoboCop. Mm. So they removed all the stuff that makes Dredd, all the kind of...
The satire
and the kind of the send-ups of modern TV or future TV and so on. They removed all that, and what you were left with was this kind of grunting Hulk killing people, which is a great pity. And I think the guys who'd written RoboCop had actually been involved with an earlier version of Judge Dredd, which was going to be a Arnold Schwarzenegger version, and they were slightly ashamed at how much they'd stolen from Dredd, but by then it was too late. And well, like I say, these things happen. The relationship between comics and films is a kind of complicated one. I mean, complicated by the fact that they steal from us and don't really pay us, frankly.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And when they do legitimately adapt, as like on A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, they don't use anything that we did, which is bizarre.
Well, they kept at least your design of the Nautilus, if nothing else.
My design of Hyde.
Okay.
That was about it. But nothing, I mean, Alan's work seems to be the first thing that was thrown out, which is a really great pity, because certainly I think the Alan Quatermain of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen was a more interesting career-ending role for Sean Connery than the part he played, which was this kind of surrogate father to Tom Sawyer. So yeah, it's complicated, but yeah, like I said, I haven't seen Hardware since back when it was first released. I mean, oddly, actually, 2 or 3 months ago, Pat Mills and I were involved with Martial Law was being optioned as a movie, and there was all this heat around it to do with McGee, who's just finished shooting Terminator Salvation, was editing it. He wanted to do Martial Law. He wanted it to be his next film. Mm. And as they say, there was all this heat. I found myself in a presidential boardroom at Warner Brothers. It was kind of bizarre meeting, which I should never have been involved with, frankly. You know, I mean, I had no role to play there other than to be an onlooker. And it went to every studio and they all balked, which is interesting. It's almost flattering to Martial Law, because they tried to remove as much Martial Law as they could to make it palatable to a Hollywood movie kind of audience. And what you ended up with, as I told them numerous times, you take too much away, what you've got is the Punisher,
yeah,
you know, really, under a different name. You've got a guy who shoots people. They didn't want to do costumes, they didn't want to do superpowers, they didn't want satire. Well, that is what we do. That's all. I mean, that is Martial Law. So the McGee version fell apart. There was a Dwayne Johnson, The Rock.
He wanted to do it
for Disney, which was so baffling to us. We just could not imagine Disney making a Martial Law movie. I mean, it just seems weird. So yeah, the relationship with films is slightly corrosive. I like films more than Alan does, and I actually think that there have been great science fiction films. There have been a few great superhero films, but mostly they chicken out, frankly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of your work, both with Pat Mills and with Alan Moore, would stand up to filmic adaptation. I mean, for example, we've got a couple of pages here for Metalzoic, which is an epic retelling of the death of the dinosaurs, except they're all robots.
All robots.
I mean, how did that come about?
Well, that was our kind of misguided... DC Comics wanted to use us. They were kind of poaching people from 2000 AD. They wanted the kind of energy of the British comic thing that was going on back in the late 70s and the 80s. And there was no way they were going to give me Batman or any of those things. So I said, well, what have you got? So we had this thing called Metalzoic, which we were going to do for a comic, an educational magazine of all things, called Look Alive. It's going to be the back cover.
Okay.
And back in those days, they didn't return our artwork. They didn't legitimately give us any credits. They certainly didn't give us any royalties. So we were just kind of doing piecework, really. But Look Alive would have given us a contract. What we did, and that fell apart. We offered it to DC. They said, great. And they were going to do it in this line of 64-page graphic novels. We had the great misfortune to come out virtually the same month as The Dark Knight, which was in that tiny square-bound... Yes, this is Metalzoic. Dark Knight was a much more attractive to Americans comic book format. And it bombed. It was it was the worst-selling thing we have ever done.
Oh, dear.
And probably the most talked about.
Because it looks great.
It had a lot of energy in it. We put tons of work in it. It just didn't work for the audience. And DC will never allow it to be reprinted.
Wow.
And they've had lots of publishers who've said we would like to do a new edition, and they won't do it.
What, DC not giving the rights back to creators to have a work reprinted elsewhere? That's so out of character.
It is so out of character. Yeah, it's astonishing, isn't it? You know, it's, and after that, we did a role playing thing, Dice Man. And that bombed. I mean, that bombed spectacularly. Again, it was a ton of work. It was one of those, you go turn to this page, you choose this adventure. We did that with Nemesis, Judge Dredd, all these characters.
Margaret Thatcher.
And a colossal amount of work. It failed miserably. So the third strike really was, what do we do next? So me and Pat were sitting around talking, and I had this idea. I'd written down this wordplay, martial law, and a rough character sketch. And I sent this to Pat, and he had a plot for a totally different story about an astronaut who became the Buck Kane public spirit character. And that we fused together, and we sold it to Marvel.
Mm.
And that became probably the most successful thing we'd done to that point, as a needs must. Because this is the kind of weird stuff that we like doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But by the time we were doing Martial Law, it was post-Dark Knight and Watchmen, and there was this appetite for superheroes. Now, the original Martial Law was very much more like Mad Max.
Mm.
Lots of exotic cars, carnage, violence, all this future stuff, with petrol-driven future, almost unimaginable now. What happened was Marvel kept us waiting a year for a contract. And in that year, Pat was kind of ringing me up and he said, you know, I don't know, maybe there's another angle on this. Maybe this guy hunts superheroes. And I said, well, don't you mean supervillains? And he said, no, superheroes, because I really hate them. I absolutely hate superheroes. I went, yeah, okay, fair enough, we'll do that. And then we pitched it to Archie Goodwin at Marvel and he said, great, go ahead. Mm. And it's to his credit, and he let us roll with it. And the big problem with Martial Law over the years, we went to many publishers and... the material became stronger and stronger, and it was harder and harder to find publishers who had the nerve to publish it. Mm. In fact, some of them, Secret Tribunal and some of those books, I'd venture to say couldn't be published today.
Wow.
Because things are so reactionary now.
The top
content.
Shelf are reprinting all of it.
Top shelf are doing all 600 odd pages of it, which is great. But they're doing it in a kind of an archive edition, says a lot. It's very hard to originate that material now because we're living in days where people are much more reactionary. Publishers, publishers, they're kind of chicken shit about what they publish.
Mm.
And the content of Law was strong. Even the content of Nemesis is quite strong compared to what's going out today.
Did you ever expect that there would be, you know, a 20-year sort of character arc going on there, that you would do the first installment and you would do the last?
No, Pat always promised me that I'd do the last one. What happened was in the early series of Nemesis, I mean, I was broke all the time, and when DC came over looking for artists, because they returned artwork and they paid us more money, it was with great regret that I left the strip to do Green Lantern Corps and all those kind of things. I didn't actually want to leave it because I enjoyed it so much, but it just didn't pay. And when we went to the publisher and said, well, can't you give us a bit more, it was kind of just bugger off. That was the attitude. You know, we can get anyone to do this stuff. You're, as Alan has said, you're kind of reusable fuel rods. You know, we can just slot in anyone to do this crap. Mm. So when you hit that attitude, you really do want to move on. And it was a wise decision in the long run to switch out of 2000 AD because it was they took advantage of an awful lot of goodwill from guys when we were all in our 20s when we started it.
Yeah.
And we poured hours and hours in it. We talked it non-stop. Dave Gibbons, Brian Bolland, Mike McMahon, everybody who worked on it was working on it 24/7. And I think the readers' reaction we got, they picked up the energy that was coming from the people who were doing the strips. But the publishers didn't appreciate any of that. In fact, they hated it. All the other comics on the floor we worked on, we were next door to Buster, who were constantly rapping on the petition saying, keep the swearing down. Why are you so noisy in there? Why does it have to be noise? Bloody science fiction comic, you know. It's curiously, back in those days when 2080 started, there were no science fiction comics.
Mm.
And the word on the floor was, we tried this years ago and it didn't work. This is going to bomb.
Mm.
You know, and when it was successful, they thought, we don't really want student money.
Mm.
That was a big argument we always had. We wanted letters pages with, like, proper letters from, you know, constructive letters from people or critical letters. And the argument always was, you can't run those letters because you give away a postal order, and a postal order is for kids. Your audience is 11. That was it. Mm. And we knew our audience was not 11. We had 11-year-olds, but we had 17, we had 30-year-olds, whatever. So it was a constant war with these people.
Mm.
At least in America, it was understood that you had an older audience.
Mm.
And they encouraged us to do more adult material, I guess. Yeah. You know.
Well, you mentioned Green Lantern as taking you away from Nemesis.
That caused a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, Unless it, and if it hadn't been written by Alan Moore, would they have let you put such weird-looking aliens in a Green Lantern strip?
Well, Alan was very jealous when I rang him up. Andy Helfer rang me up when I sent him the artwork in and said, we've got a real problem with this strip, because it was meant to run a couple of years earlier. He said the comics code have rung us up and said we can't run it.
Mm.
And he said to them, what do we change to make it acceptable? And they said, nothing. The art style is completely unacceptable to the comics code. It just makes us very uncomfortable. You can't really tell from that page. It's a kind of whispering... Actually, I don't know. We're looking at it now. It's nothing in it, is there?
No,
it's such a load of wusses, aren't they, really? They didn't like it. They didn't like the subtext of it. They didn't like the crucified alien. So Andy Helfer, he held it back, I think, about a year, and they ran it without a comic code sticker. That's essentially what happened to that. But, like I said, Alan was very jealous because it wasn't banned for the words. It was banned for the artwork, and he wanted it to be banned for the words as well. but it's a good story. Now, I think some of this material, well, Alan's material, not mine, is a basis for all this new Green Lantern stuff they're doing,
at
the moment.
And of course, now your work with Alan is on The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the new volume of which came out 2 days ago, I believe.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
If you look at your art style now, it's a lot kind of softer, the lines. I mean, was that something that you developed on purpose as you approached more realistic material?
It really was. I mean, what I'd done, I actually said to Alan when he rang me up and offered it to me, I mean, it's kind of dream come true to all these characters from classic fiction. It was a killer idea, and I'd wanted to work with Alan for years, and we'd done bits and pieces together, but the big series we wanted to do had always got kind of stymied. So this was kind of greenlit, as they say. It was up and running, but when I started to draw it, I realised it took me about 10 pages to get into it, because I've been drawing so much violence, Lobo, martial law, all this stuff, so many heads coming off, so many bullet hits, so many people exploding. And this, it's quieter. It's got a central, I mean, Mina Harker, the central female, Mina Murray, central female figure. There's a lot of still scenes in it, and I had to really rethink the way I drew to approach that. And it's kind of gratifying that she's so enormously popular, given that she has, despite the movie, she has no powers, she's not a vampire. She's just a very tough Victorian woman who can kind of hold this group of incredibly powerful men together, which the movie couldn't buy into. They could not buy into that idea that a woman can boss Sean Connery about. it was never going to fly. It says a lot about the world we live in, doesn't it, really? That you can buy it in a Victorian period when it should be unfathomable, frankly, that she would lead a group like that. But I loved it, and I love my favourite scenes in League were, say, Mr. Hyde talking to her when they're sitting in the tavern, and he's very soft and menacing, and he's talking about maybe taking her head off, and it's just a gentle way to talk. And a later scene where he kills the Invisible Man, which I think is probably my favourite scene of the whole series.
And one of the most horrific.
And funny enough, the editor Scott Dumbia rang me up when he got the script and said, be careful how you draw that scene, mate. And I said, but there's nothing in it. There's nothing, you can't see anything. He said, well, I don't know, everyone was uncomfortable about it, and it's much talked about. And funny enough, when I visited the movie set when they were making the film, they regretted that not being in the film. Everybody, all the actors wanted those scenes. They wanted those kind of prime scenes, this kind of excess, or Mina throwing a bucket of paint over the Invisible Man to find him. That stuff. We lost all of that.
Yeah.
Or they lost all of that. You know, we had no influence on the movie. But yeah, like I say, it did soften my style somewhat, or calm it down. And I very much enjoy working on it. The one I'm working on at the moment is set in 1969. And it's become incredibly complex now because we have to avoid copyright issues. Which the Black Dossier was weaving in and out of all the time. But we want to get everybody in it. It's almost everything that we've ever experienced is poured into this. Every fictional version of Aleister Crowley is kind of poured into this. So you've got this occult story, and you've got this kind of disintegrating a trio of Quatermain, Mina Harker, or Mina Murray, and Orlando, with this weird sexual relationship they have going on, which is kind of fluid because Orlando changes gender every so often. So there's all that going on, and I love it. It's and as Alan said, we couldn't have kept it as a Victorian strip because that group would never have held.
Yeah,
it's not a Justice League. Those people were bursting apart all the time. So we got the best out of it, and we've moved on.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think for a while Alan was saying that this third volume was going to be the last, but now he's actually saying that he'd be happy to go on doing it for years. I mean, are you particularly enjoying the freedom, in fact, of being able to draw every single literary character that Alan fancies writing?
It is, since Jess Nevins does these books which analyse it panel by panel, it kind of puts a huge amount of pressure on it, because now almost we know that every corner of every panel is analysed, and they read things into pictures which actually aren't there, and there's other stuff that gets missed. And what we don't want is for people to think they're excluded from enjoying it because they don't understand the references. It actually doesn't matter if you don't recognise these characters from that old TV series or whatever. It doesn't matter. They're just characters, they're just names, they're billboards and things. If you do, it's another texture of fiction running through the whole thing. And at the moment, we've got a lot of fictional gangsters in a 1969 book, and we've got this huge, as to be expected from Alan, psychedelic sequence, a monstrously huge psychedelic sequence, which I think people will love, which we're doing. But then when we jump into our present day, we're in Afghanistan, and we've got fictional Afghanistan running kind of slightly parallel to real Afghanistan, so that's interesting. And then after that, we're going to go back to the early 60s and do this kind of slightly fascinating but crappy British superhero group made up of the very, very poor super characters we had in the 6mm comics back in the 50s and 60s. So that will be, I'm looking forward to that. That's going to be a really good one as well. But yeah, I think I am going to probably die in a saddle on it, frankly. Okay. Yeah. It's whichever one of us gives up the ghost first on it. You know, it's,
but it did mean doing something like the Black Dossier meant you got to draw things like Fireball, X-Hall 5, James Bond, if I'm allowed to say that, characters from the Avengers and so on, which is almost the antithesis of some of Pat's work, which is coming from hating.
Well,
Alan's work comes from actually, you know, some sort of heartfelt nostalgia.
A great love, except for, dare I mention, James Bond, who we treated as we did when we were fair to Fleming's version, which is this a misogynistic brute, really. I mean, he's not a nice character. He's very much based on Bulldog Drummond, you know, and Bulldog Drummond is not a nice character. He's an anti-Semitic thug. However, putting the two of them together, Drummond is slightly nicer than James Bond.
Yeah,
you know, he's a kind of an honest, ignorant oaf, whereas Bond is a dishonest, ignorant oaf. We had so much trouble with the Black Dossier. Every single panel, every line, which was approved by lawyers at the last minute, was disapproved. And in fact, they were asking for changes at the end, which would have created more copyright problems than leaving it alone in the first place. I mean, because we have Mary Poppins, we had Snow White, we had all these characters kind of weaving in and out, kind of, so what, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they weren't all having an orgy in an opium.
It was felt, I mean, that's the trouble with working for a big publisher like DC. They got very, very deep pockets, they're part of Time Warner. And they felt that if Disney sued them, they're going to sue them for real. Whereas I think at Top Shelf, we've got less money, frankly.
Publish and be damned.
Publish and be damned, yes. Yes. But I mean, you might be doing this interview from prison next year.
Well, you know. When you look at your own influences on your work, I mean, I talked to both Alan and Pat early in the year about Ken Reed, about how he was an artist that they both admired. And they both suspected that he may be an influence on your work, with sort of some of the strange monsters that he created and so on.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, when I was a kid, I mean, because I was an incredible fantasist, I think many of my compadres in the business are. The comics I grew up in, the Beano and the Dandies and so on, they had all this kind of junk in there, the Black Bobs and things like that, which I absolutely detested. I resented every panel they took up, those crappy strips. And I knew those were the things the publishers really liked because they were pushing them all the time. But the stuff I liked was Jonah, Ken Reed's Jonah, which was a work of absolute genius. And it ran parallel to the kind of Goon Show. This is the 50s. And a level of detail, I mean, Ken Reed would put like 20 panels onto a page. Mm. And you think this is absolutely mind-boggling. And of course, with that, there was Bill Elder on Mad Magazine and those people. And it was a level of detail. The fact you could go back and you could find more and more in their work, which appealed to me as a kid.
Well, it's interesting you should say Jonah, because there is this sort of wailing leitmotif going on in Nemesis.
Yes, yeah, so I suppose that's fair enough, yeah. It's Pat Mills is a big fan of Jonah. Alan Moore is a big fan of Jonah. I mean, those things, it's like being bitten by a radioactive spider. You know, they hit you early enough in your life and they stay with you for life. And when you get an opportunity to big up these people who are not as well known today as they should be, Ken Reed should be a major British figure. He should be better known. They don't reprint his stuff at DC Thompson's. There are no books on his career. Mm. And there should be. And that's true of a lot of these artists. Even Frank Bellamy, who was a superb artist, and there's no book on his career. It's a great pity. This country sometimes forgets its own. Mm. I mean, I've seen Italian books on British artists, but there's no translation of them. Mm. It's a little bit shameful. But we've always fought in this country this idea that comics are associated with juvenile delinquency. And it's taken years and years and years to get over that. And as soon as you get over that, you hit the Batman TV show.
Yeah.
And then think, oh my God, we've got to go back to square one again. You get over there and you get Action, which was like the Sevenpenny Dreadful thing, and the, oh God, they've got a policeman being pulverised on the cover. And so we're only just getting over that.
Well, it seems like you have waves of both types of comics and types of comic art every, you know, maybe generation that seems a real slap in the face and seems quite controversial in America. Maybe in the 60s there was the likes of, I don't know, Harvey Kurtzman and Basil Wolverton. And then when you guys did 2000 AD in the late 70s, maybe your art, Mick McMahon's art, I mean, it seems really kind of strong and different to anything else that was out there. Did you feel like you were taking a risk? Or you thought that because the comic itself was trying to tap into that sort of young male teenage audience that hadn't been reading comics, it was worth, you know, giving it a go?
Well, it's curious. I mean, when I started it, I started in comics when I was 16. Yeah. This was 1970, and the feeling then was all the guys I worked with were ex-World War II veterans, effectively. And they hated being in comics for the most part. They absolutely hated it. They'd rather have been in anything else. A Caravan Monthly would have been infinitely superior to working in crappy old comics. They loathed it. And that came across, I think, to the readers, ultimately. But you had this kind of... this stuff, which had been very vital in its early days, Valiant and all those things, been full of invention, had some great artists and some very clever writers, had become formulaic, and you had house styles, you had to draw in a certain style. What Pat Mills did when he came along was he said, no house styles, there's not going to be a house style, I don't care how Judge Dredd is drawn, as long as it's good. So that was terrific. We all were freed up. And also our generation were influenced by the underground comics that were coming out of America and the French band Désigné, which we were just beginning to see, full of all the Jean Giraud stuff and Drillier, all these people who were doing this marvellous inventive stuff. And we wanted to do that, but there was no platform until Pat Mills created 2000 AD. And it hit this huge audience, this colossal audience. And people often say it's to do with Star Wars, and actually it wasn't. Star Wars might have been the thing that... an article on Star Wars might have given it the impetus to the thing. What's forgotten is, when we were producing the first issue, the things that came out were Logan's Run, which was the end of old Hollywood science fiction. People in togas.
Or from the director of the Dam Busters.
Very old-fashioned. And A Boy and His Dog, which is like an independent film. Things like that. Damnation Alley, which was a cheap, shabby film. We were actually up and running when Star Wars came out. And Star Wars kind of huggy-feely world is nothing like 2000 AD's kind of cynical world.
But you were the Sex Pistols, you know.
And of course, the punk thing was the other thing that was running parallel to 2000 AD in that year, 76. It was a kind of vital year. There was kind of rubbish on the streets. The world was going to hell in a handbasket. Punk music was confusing everybody. And you had this kind of comic coming out of a space spinner on it, which I know put a lot of the older readers off for two or three weeks, all those crappy free gifts. And then after issue four, we suddenly got an audience. And we started getting letters in, and we realised we're reaching what they hated, students. IPC didn't want a studio audience. They hated it. And we were reaching the older audience, people who were coming back to comics. So that was a huge shift.
Cool. Thank you very much. I mean, you know, at least...
back to the film.
I'd like to think that the film we're showing now, at least Hardware, captures some of that punk aesthetic. I mean, from the obvious, like casting Iggy Pop and Lemmy in part, to, you know, that kind of dirty.
I think the director was a kindred spirit.
Cool.
Clearly a wonderful madman, like the rest of us.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more info about Sci-Fi London, please visit their website at www.sci-fi-london.com. And to see Kevin's work on display in the gallery environment, where you can also buy his original artwork, please visit the Illustration Cupboard near Green Park in London before the end of September. More info at www.illustrationcupboard.com. While we're on the subject of the recognition of British comic book artists for their work, Strip and Resonance FM would like to take this opportunity to congratulate Brian Talbot on his honorary doctorate from the University of Sunderland for his work in the comics medium. And according to historian Paul Gravett, this is the first time a British comics creator has been recognised in the field formally. It's great to see Brian's work recognised, and I hope this is the start of many doctorates being awarded to comic book creators. Next week is the start of Children's Comics Fortnight on the show, and I'm talking to Terry Deary and Martin Brown about their hugely successful series of children's books, Horrible Histories. Before that, you can hear an extended podcast of today's show at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. And Strip, we'll be back at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.